You're listening to an audio resource from Vineyard Church of the Rockies in Fort Collins, Colorado. We are joining God's mission, transforming all things, and you're invited. To learn more about us and how you can connect, please visit votr.church.
Well, good morning. It's so good to see you all for worship today. My name is Matt Farron. I'm one of the pastors here at the Vineyard. And we are continuing our summer series called The Best Sermon Ever. Now, spoiler alert, it's not actually the sermon that's about to happen. It was a sermon that happened about 2,000 years ago that was preached by Jesus, not me, and it was the Sermon on the Mount. And it's found at the front part of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and we're covering and working our way through the Gospel of Matthew. And this morning we're going to be in Matthew chapter 5. So if you have your Bibles with you, you can go ahead and flip to Matthew chapter 5. We're going to be there in just a moment. It'll be on the screens for you if you don't have a Bible. But I just want to welcome you all to church this morning. Thank you so much for worshiping with us here in the room. If you're joining us on the live stream, we're so glad that you've tuned in this morning, taking a little bit of time wherever you're at, whether it's here in Larimer County or up in the mountains or somewhere else in the world. Thank you for worshiping with us. And I also wanted to let you know that you can follow along on the sermon notes today at votrweekly.org. So if you're using the Bible app on your phone, you can flip between your browser and the Bible and follow along on the sermon notes there. It's got announcements, the songs that we sing, everything that's going on at the Vineyard, so you can follow along there. But I want to start with a story this morning, a story that took place a few years ago on a warm summer night in Washington, D.C. 8 friends gathered for a celebratory dinner in a backyard patio. And they were toasting family and friends and the grand opening of a brand new restaurant that one of them had just opened. And a man named Michael was there with his wife and his 14-year-old daughter. And he described it as a magical night. Everybody was having a great time. And it was getting kind of late. They were drinking fancy cheese, or drinking fancy wine and eating fancy cheese. I mean, brie is almost drinkable sometimes if it's hot. But they were, you know, the wine and cheese game. And everything was going great. And then around 10 p.m., it happened. Michael was standing beside his wife when this arm came in between them with a long-barreled pistol. All of a sudden, there's this man. It was like in slow motion, holding a gun in the middle of their circle. And it got really quiet at the party. And this uninvited guest interrupted what otherwise would be a perfect evening, and he raised his gun first to the head of Michael's friend, Christina, and then he put his gun to the head of Michael's wife, and he just kept repeating, "Give me your money or I'll start shooting." And he looked anxious and nervous, and his eyes were wide, and his tone was really aggressive. And when he said he would shoot, they believed him. But there was a problem. No one at the party had any money on them, like no cash to be found. And so they just started talking, grasping at anything that could dissuade this man. And naturally, they started with guilt, right? That's where you start. What would your mother think? To which the man just shouted, "I don't have a mother." Like, no matter what they tried, it just contributed to this environment of danger. Things just seemed to be ratcheting up. Michael remembers thinking that this was headed to a very bad end. Like, someone was going to get hurt, if not everyone. But then, Christina, the woman whose head the gun had first been raised to, she piped up with an idea, with an invitation. She said to the man, "You know, we're here celebrating. Why don't you have a glass of wine and join us?" And Michael said that it was like a switch, that you could feel the difference, and all of a sudden the man's face changed, and he accepted her invitation, and they poured him some wine. And as he reached down for that drinkable cheese, he put his gun in his pocket and he sat down. For a moment, they all sat there together, sipping wine, eating their fancy cheese, and the only sound was crickets in the night air. And then this man said something totally unexpected. Totally out of the blue. He said, "Can I get a hug?" To quote Michael here, he said, I can tell you how strange it was that we all stood up and gathered around him in a circle and gave him a hug. After the hug, the man said he was sorry. And he slipped out the back gate just as quietly as he'd come with his glass of wine. The whole group, like, major exhale moment. They ran into the house to cry and to hug, like half tears of gratitude and half tears of fear and relief, right? Michael said it was a miracle what had just happened. And this story was a real life example of what psychologists have come to call non-complementary behavior. You see, typically, people naturally mirror each other. A calm person brings a calm response, and warmth begets warmth. And when someone is hostile to you, you tend to match their hostility. But subverting this pattern, like being really kind to the man who's trying to rob your dinner party, that's non-complimentary behavior. It doesn't mirror. And according to psychologists, it's incredibly hard to do, but it can be incredibly effective. And what's fascinating is that non-complimentary behavior is a relatively new term for something that was first taught about 2,000 years ago by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. And it's our text today in Matthew chapter 5. So let's read together Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 38. It says, "You have heard the law that says the punishment must match the injury, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, offer the other cheek also. If you're sued in a court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. Give to those who ask. And don't turn away from those who want to borrow." Verse 43, Jesus continues, "You have heard the law that says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. For he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good. He sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you're kind only to your friends, how are you any different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." This is the word of the Lord. So let's work through this passage of scripture, verse by verse. Let's look back at verse 38. Jesus says, "You've heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth." And Jesus is quoting Exodus chapter 21. It's where this first shows up. And it sounds really, quite harsh and brutal and archaic to our ears today. But if we could go back about 3,500 years we'd find a very different world. We'd find a place that was dark and cruel and barbaric and violent, full of intertribal warfare and bloody family feuds. And before we get all judgy about our savage ancestors, let's take a breath and recognize that we're not all that different or enlightened today, because human nature is to mirror and to escalate, right? Think about it, guys. If someone starts something with you, what is your natural response to them? Really? What? Yeah, it's on, right? You're going to protect yourself. You're going to make sure, whatever the situation is. But here's the thing. Is it just to get even? Or is it maybe to one-up them just a little? Right? Maybe both? Like, think about the last time someone cut you off in traffic. What entered your mind? Whether you acted on it or not, what entered your mind in that moment? Right? Maybe to speed up a little, to catch back up with them, or pass them, get back in front of them. Maybe tap the brakes a little, brake check. We escalate. Renowned Fuller ethicist Lewis Mead said, "The problem with revenge is that it never evens the score. It ties both the injured and the injurer to an escalator of pain. Both are stuck on the escalator as long as parity is demanded. And the escalator never stops." What an image, right? This escalator of pain. Can you imagine just like getting your shoelace caught in the escalator of pain and just being taken to the top? So into that environment, this environment of endless escalation, God speaks in Exodus 21, and he puts a limit on revenge. He limited retribution down to just justice, down to what would match the crime originally. Not vigilante justice that was carried out by the victim and their family, but justice that was administered by a court. This was way ahead of its time. In fact, this is where we get lex talionis. In legal terms, the punishment should fit the crime. It's still a cornerstone of the justice system today. It's from this scripture in Exodus 21. And so Jesus here is saying, you've heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Like from the time of Moses until that day, this was the system. And then Jesus continued, but I say, do not resist an evil person. It's pretty provocative. Now, let's talk about this word resist, because it's a really tricky word to translate. Jesus isn't instructing his followers to just roll over and take it. This isn't a word to simple passivism with no thought. In fact, we see Jesus resist evil time and time again in his life and ministry in lots of different ways. A more literal and helpful translation of this word, resist, might be don't repay, don't take violent revenge on an evil person. Don't try to get even. New Testament scholar N.T. Wright said, don't use violence to resist evil. So, who are the evil people that we bump into? How do we deal with them? What did Jesus have in mind? Well, he goes on to give four glimpses of common daily occurrences from Jesus' first century Palestinian world. 2,000 years ago, the examples that Jesus gives would have been things that the people that were there in attendance at the Sermon on the Mount, they may have seen some of these things that morning on the way or that week. This would have been part of their kind of normal life. And Jesus spoke right into their life. And because so much time has passed, we need to do a little work to understand them culturally. And so let's take a look. The rest of verse 39. It says, if someone slaps you on the right cheek, offer the other cheek also. Now, a slap, think about a slap. It's not just an act of violence. It's not just about inflicting physical pain, right? Slapping is about shame. And in first century Israel, this was an honor-shame culture. For them, the worst thing that could happen is shame. Like not poverty, not death. The worst thing possible would have been shame. Like shame on your family's name. And since the vast majority of slappers in the world are right-handed, Jesus was referring to a backhanded slap, right? Think about a right-handed person slapping someone else's right cheek. Jesus is talking about a backhand that would have been given from a place of power, privilege, to someone who was seen as less than. This was the ultimate insult to shame them. And aside from the Will Smith situation, there aren't a lot of slaps in our culture today, but we do have Twitter. New methods, same old shame. This is not about physical altercations or victims of abuse. Hear me. Jesus is speaking to the insulted, to the demeaned, the maligned, the slandered. And he says that while you are still reeling with shame, before the sting has even subsided, turn the other cheek. Think about taking a backhand to your right cheek and the impact that that would be. And to turn the other cheek would literally mean that you have to turn past that person's eye line again, to meet their eyes, to offer your other cheek, to stay engaged in the exchange and to see them as a like person to person, as an equal, to disrupt the power dynamics at play here and the pecking order, and to meet their eyes. And doing this would not only be dignifying, but something else might happen. They might not hit you again. Yep, that's the risk. That's the implication of what Jesus is saying. Like, offer the other cheek, not for a smooch necessarily. They might strike again, but they might not. Your bold, courageous act might expose their feeling of superiority in the situation. It might just lead to a change of heart, a change of mind, a change of course. Let's look at Jesus' next example in verse 40. If you're sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. What's interesting is that in this day, there were really only two articles of clothing of any substance. There's your shirt and your coat. And shirt, think more like kind of a long tunic or a long dress. It would have gone down past your waist. But your coat, like, people only had one coat. And it was vital to survival. It doubled as your blanket at night. It was like your backpack, sort of. Whatever you had to carry would go in your coat for the journey. It was so vital that it was actually against the law to take someone's coat for more than a few hours. And here, Jesus is saying, if someone sues you and they want to take you for everything you got, every penny, the shirt off your back, don't hire a more expensive lawyer. Don't countersue for $10 million. But here is a gospel way, a Jesus-shaped way to deal with that. Give them what they're legally entitled to, but don't stop there. Choose to give them your coat too. Give them everything. And I know that that leaves you exposed. It leaves you at risk. But understand that you're not the only one exposed here, that it also exposes their greed, their ruthlessness. And when you respond with lavish generosity, with grace, with creative, non-complimentary action, it exposes their heart right there in court for all to see. Keep reading, verse 41. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it too. By law, a Roman military officer could force anyone to carry their pack, about 40 or 50 pounds, for 1,000 paces. And you had no choice in the matter. You're out running errands, or you're on a date, or you're on a time crunch, right in the middle of your day, and all of a sudden you hear, "Hey, you, carry my stuff." It's a total interruption. Can you imagine the humiliation of that, the resentment down deep in your bones every time that it happened? And so Jesus is saying, when someone crashes your schedule, when your livelihood is come against, when someone imposes an unfair policy, when they interrupt your plans and your strategy, when you don't get your way, in those moments, here's what the gospel looks like. Here's a creative, redemptive way to deal with that. Go the extra mile. And I know that this phrase, go the extra mile, like it's almost a cliche for us today. But stop and think about this. Like, what Jesus is saying here is incredibly subversive. To love that soldier, to serve that soldier when you don't have to. Like, start a conversation. You got a two-mile walk. Chat. Ask them about their family. Ask them how it feels to be serving in a place where it's apparent that no one really wants them there. Ask them what it's like to be so far away from home. Humanize your enemy. Show them that you're not just a victim. You're not weak. In love, you can make a choice to serve in a redemptive way. In almost every circumstance, it's always an option to us. And we have seen that kind of non-complimentary, non-violent resistance change the world. What if we try it? Jesus' last example is about money. Everybody exhale. It's quick. Verse 42. Give to those who ask, and don't turn away from those who want to borrow. And remember, the vast majority of people who are listening to Jesus right now are dirt poor. We have records that the Romans would tax the territories that they occupied at a rate of 70 to 90%. Like, the empire was thriving, but the territories where they occupied, not so much. They were left in abject poverty. And so Jesus is saying here, like, even when you're just barely scraping by, when it's not in the budget, when it is not convenient or planned, refuse to look away from needs. Don't look away. Don't avoid it. We can't always give what's being asked for. And sometimes that's not even the best way to help, right? Like, if we've learned anything from Fort Collins Rescue Mission, sometimes there are other better ways to help. But we can always put our money and our resources to work for justice in the world. And these four examples, like I said, they were common experiences for the people who were there listening to Jesus. But don't get too hung up on the specifics. Make it personal to you. What are the situations in your life that you could practice non-complimentary behavior? With your family, your next-door neighbor, your HOA board, your boss, your political antagonists. Now let's sip a coffee and let that one settle. Duke ethicist John Howard Yoder wrote that what is wrong with the world is most fundamentally that people respond to evil with evil. The iron necessity of retaliation, or lex talionis, it intends to preserve human society from chaos, but in reality, it guarantees at best a continuing chain of evil. At worst, it escalates like pouring oil on fire. Non-retaliation is the only way to break the chain of causation. And boy, have I contributed to some causes, some chains of causation. At the end of fifth grade, my family moved from central Illinois to southern Illinois, a really small town where my dad had accepted the call to pastor. For the first 10 years of my life, Dad served a really large church of about 1,200 people. Our new town was half that size of our church. This was a difficult move for me, to say the least. Lots of adjustments. It was hard being an outsider. And everybody knew I was the preacher's kid. For the first time in my life, I was being bullied. And a few months after our move, the church had a potluck dinner on a farm just outside of the town. And everyone was there eating casserole, doing what you do if you've been to a potluck. Everybody's having a good time. But not me. I was getting picked on by a kid named Jeff. Jeff. Actually, he went by Jeffy. Ugh. It's 1988, and Jeffy is making my life miserable. At dusk, everybody loaded up for a hayrack ride, and Jeffy took that opportunity to really ratchet it up. I had hay in my face, down my shirt. I was near tears. And then he took my hat, my favorite hat, that was given to me by a girl before we moved. And Jeffy threw the hat off the hay rack. We're in a place I've never been, totally unfamiliar. It's dark outside. In my mind, he just threw my hat into the abyss. It is gone forever. I was seething mad, and I had had all I could take. As soon as we got back to the farmhouse, I ran up to Jeffy and I punched him right in the face. I realize that this is the second week in a row that one of your pastors has talked about getting in fistfights. A lot has happened since those times. I don't remember much about what happened after I punched Jeffy. I remember my hand hurt so bad. I was not expecting that reality of a punch. It hurts bad. I remember the entire church staring at me, standing over Jeffy. And I remember the look on my parents' faces. Later that night, Jeffy came to me, hat in hand. Literally, he had gone back and found my hat on the side of the road and brought it back to me and gave it back, and he apologized. I didn't want an apology. I did not want to forgive Jeffy. Everybody was watching, and I knew that he had taken the high road. He had exposed my heart. But we talked for a while, and eventually I did forgive him. And after a few eyebrow, head nod, throat clear things from my mom, I apologize to Jeffy. And he forgave me too. And we buried the hatchet, or whatever it is that you bury in fifth grade. I don't know, Twinkie. And we moved on, and we were friends from then on. And don't you see that Jeffy decided not to continue the feud? Jeffy was the one who chose non-complimentary behavior. He could have escalated, and believe me, it would not have gone well for me. But instead, Jeffy opted to end it. He made a way for both of us to get off of that escalator of pain, and I'm glad he did. Now, Jesus is not done. We've still got a few more verses to dig into, and he goes even deeper, right to the heart of the matter. So let's check out verse 43. You've heard the law that says, love your enemy, hate your neighbor. And again, Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament, but this time it's a little different. He's done this. This is now the sixth time Jesus has said, you've heard the law that says, and he quotes the Old Testament, but this one kind of stands alone. And I actually want to look at it in Leviticus chapter 19, where Jesus is quoting. In verse 18, it says, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So love your neighbor as yourself. Yeah, check. There it is right there. But notice what's missing. Where did hate your enemy come from? Like, it's not here. It's not in Leviticus 19. It's not in the Bible. God never said it. So where would they have possibly heard it said to hate your enemy? Obviously, this was a common phrase, and Jesus is saying, you've all heard this. And this was the common interpretation of this verse in Leviticus 19 in Jesus' day. They figured that when God commanded to love your neighbor as yourself, it necessitated a definition. Who exactly qualifies as neighbor? This is why Jesus had people come up to him and ask, Jesus, who is my neighbor? The whole story of the Good Samaritan is in response to that very question. It's not because they needed help identifying who to love. It's because they were curious about loopholes and exclusions. Guys, definitions matter. For instance, my son really does need to know what qualifies as dessert. It's an important definition in our house. But often, the letter of the law, when it's isolated from the heart of the law, it leads to a very different end. And Jesus isn't playing the semantics game. Right? Jesus knows that leftover sirloin is not dessert. He knows that the Disney Channel, not dessert. And more importantly, he knows that neighbor means neighbor. And he's about to end the whole notion of the category of non-neighbor. Jesus continues in verse 44, but I say, love your enemies. Neighbors, enemies, love them. Love them all. But we're not done with the semantics game in that little sentence. We've clarified neighbor and enemy. Now we also need to clarify love, especially because today for us, we're not helped by our English vocabulary, right? I love my wife and I love chocolate peanut butter Häagen-Dazs. The same four letters, very different meanings. But the word Jesus uses here is agape. You may have heard it around church before. It's usually used referring to God's unconditional love. That is how Jesus wants us to engage our enemies, agape love. This isn't superficial ice cream love. This isn't gushy emotional love. This is more an act of your will. C.S. Lewis said, love is not affectionate feeling, but a steady wish for the loved person's ultimate good as far as it can be obtained. That's his definition of agape love. So if you're anything like me at this point, like I'm thinking, okay, Jesus, agape my enemies. Where do I even start with that? I'm glad I asked, because he actually gives a practical first step in the second part of verse 44. Keep reading, it says, pray for those who persecute you. Really pray. Honest prayers about the situation. Tell God about it. Tell God how it makes you feel. And then ask God to open your heart and your mind to them, to help you love them, and pray for their blessing. Not that hail would hit their car in the parking lot at work. Pray for their blessing, for their salvation, for their healing, for provision. Guys, I'm not saying that this is easy, but it's doable, right? For all of us, we could pray. What if we prayed for our enemies? What if we prayed for the people who persecuted us? It's a practical starting point, a first step. Because what happens when you pray for your enemy is that your heart changes. If you pray long enough, they cease to be your enemy. And even better, you cease to be their victim. If you pray for someone, you move from anger and bitterness, and you get God's eyes for them, God's heart. As I have found in my own life that praying for my abuser, praying for my enemy, was actually a key in my healing. It transformed my heart. It actually changes us. So pray. Start with prayer. Now, check this out. Verse 45, Jesus continues again. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven, for he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good. He sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you look way back and you follow the story of God from the beginning of the world, through to Abraham and Joseph and Moses, through David and Solomon, the prophets, all the way to Jesus, and even extending that story all the way to us here today. This is what God has always been about. We can see it in what's called common grace. God's blessing to the evil and the good, to the just and the unjust alike. The same sunshine, the same rain, the same blessings and love and invitation. This is what God is like since the very beginning. God has revealed his love. He has lavished his love. He has changed his enemies into his very own children. This is what God has done for you and for me. And now we are invited to be like him, to be like our Father. Verse 46 says, if you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you're kind to only your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. Jesus holds our fickle love up to the light and juxtaposes it against God's great love. And he picked tax collectors and pagans here as comparisons because they were universally hated. They were the enemies, the worst of the worst. Remember, tax collectors were Jewish people who had turned their back on their own people and were taxing 70 to 90% of their own people. They were getting rich off of the empire, off of the pagan Romans. And Jesus says, how are you any different? You feel superior to them, like you have the moral high ground, but your love looks more like theirs than it looks like mine. When we limit our love to those we deem lovable, just hear this, if we somehow control and limit our love to only those who we think are lovable, aren't we just ignoring how God has loved us? Think about your story. Remember what God has done for you. Remember where you were when he found you, when he saved you. Did he wait until we were lovable? No, instead of wrath and judgment and retribution and condemnation, instead of the things that we deserved in our sin, the Father has loved us with grace and mercy and healing and salvation. Second chances. So many second chances. That is what we have been given by God, and that is what we have to give to the people around us. And I know this sounds completely impractical. Like, this is impossible. This is unattainable. Jesus, this is out of touch with the real world. But guys, he actually did it. He's the one who actually lived this out and loved his enemies all the way to death on the cross. He is the hero that has broken the chain of evil and made a way for us to follow. The Apostle Paul picks this up in Romans chapter 5. He says, "But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners. And since we have been made right with God in God's sight by the blood of Christ, he will certainly save us from God's condemnation. For since our friendship with God was restored by the death of his son while we were still his," what? "Enemies. We will certainly be saved through the life of his son." Guys, take a look at this chart from Glenn Stassen's little book, Living the Sermon on the Mount. On the left, we have like traditional righteousness, traditional love, complementary behavior, mirroring, love neighbor, hate enemy. And that works good until things start escalating. And then we find ourselves in this vicious cycle of only loving the people who are like us and love us back. And round we go. It takes what's on the right there, transforming initiative, something drastic, something non-complimentary to break the cycle. And that is enemy love. Enemy love breaks this vicious cycle. And through the cross of Christ, the ultimate act of non-complimentary behavior, God has broken the cycle in our lives. Between us and him, the enmity between us and God has been broken. And God has lavished his love on us and made us his sons and daughters. And we are invited to continue this work and invite as many people as possible into this great love. This is a huge part of joining God's mission, transforming all things. Right? Empowered by the Holy Spirit, carrying his love until every enemy has been welcomed as a neighbor. This is what our world needs. Finally, in verse 48, it says, "But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." All right, so we know what we have to work on this week. Have a good one. Good luck with that. But Jesus is repeating and restating a verse that's throughout the Old Testament, "Be holy as I am holy." And the word here that Jesus used for perfect is the same root where we get teleology, like the end goal, the aim, the ultimate end. This could be referred to as be mature as your Father is mature. Be complete as your Father is complete. And Jesus placed this teaching of giving up revenge, of loving your enemy, by saying, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Jesus is placing that teaching at the very core of life in his kingdom. This isn't secondary or some side issue. Later in Matthew, Jesus is asked, what is the greatest commandment? And if you know the story and you know how Jesus answered, he said, love God. And the second commandment is just like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, the whole law and the prophets, the entire covenant between God and his people, it all hangs on those two things. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus just said, by the way, your enemy is your neighbor. And this is at the very center of kingdom living. And if that's the end we're aiming for, if that's the telos, then this is a pretty good measuring stick, an opportunity to get a realistic assessment of our spiritual maturity, right? So, some questions to ponder. To what degree do you take revenge? Do you have to get them back and one-up them? To what degree do you love your enemies? This is the degree to which we are spiritually mature and like our Father. I think back with me all the way back to Washington, D.C., to that dinner in the back patio. Later in the evening, after everything had calmed down, the group found the wine glass that the man had taken with him, and it was neatly placed outside the back gate. Not thrown, not shattered, not carelessly discarded. It was placed there. Let's pray together.